federal government is offering us money, and for the governor to reject that money just is unconscionable.
The state says no to $1 million to implement the new health care law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 5th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, confronting the high suicide rate in Western Alaska.
Now, even I thought about suicide before. Even this past winter, I was close to attempting.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
When the federal government announced last week that every state will get $1 million to help pay for a new piece of the national health care law, just two states were left off the list, Alaska and Minnesota. They didn't apply. Alaska's governor doesn't want the money. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, critics of the Parnell administration say that decision hurts Alaskans.
States are setting up online marketplaces for health insurance so consumers and small businesses can shop around for the best policy. It's supposed to be like websites that show competing car insurance rates or price out plane tickets, and it's a cornerstone of the six-month-old healthcare law. Jay Angoff directs the Federal Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight and says each state will have its own marketplace to suit local needs.
They enable consumers to band together and to get a better deal than they would if they just bought insurance individually.
The federal $1 million will help states plan these consumer marketplaces, but the state of Alaska said no thanks to the money. Alaska is one of 20 states suing over the health care law, claiming that it's unconstitutional to force people to buy insurance. The other states suing are still taking the federal funds. Yet Alaska's Division of Insurance Director Linda Hall says if Alaska is against making people buy insurance, why set up a consumer marketplace?
The exchange is the vehicle through which individuals could purchase the insurance that the Act mandates. And since that is the part of the Act that individual mandate is what's being considered unconstitutional, we're not going to accept federal money to develop a vehicle to implement that part of the Act.
Anchorage State Senator Hollis French says he's disturbed that Alaska is rejecting the money. The Democrat says while he too has some concerns about the health care law, the marketplace is a great way to educate people about their options and help them save money.
So it's important to construct this marketplace the right way. The federal government is offering us money to help us do that, and for the governor to reject that money just is unconscionable.
Senator Mark Begich voted for the health care bill in Washington, and his spokeswoman Julie Haskett says the governor is treating the law like a political pinata.
It is too bad if Alaskans are not only going to not know what's going on, we're not going to take advantage of the resources available to make this new law work, and we're just going to pretend like it's not there.
Begich and French are upset that Alaska has rejected other federal health care funds, like $250 million nationwide, that's going to states to make sure insurance companies aren't unfairly raising their rates. Most states applied, but Alaska did not. Senator French complained in a letter to Governor Parnell Tuesday that it should have.
A lot of insurance policies are raising their rates. They're claiming it's because of this new federal health care bill. The federal government is offering states money to analyze this, because what a lot of consumers don't know is that most insurance regulation is done at the state level.
But the state's Linda Hall says Alaska's market is so small that her office doesn't need the federal money.
Currently, there is only one company who writes health insurance in Alaska, whose rates have to be approved by the Division of Insurance before they're used. So the grant amount was $1 million, and we didn't have what we consider to be valid uses of that kind of money when our market is so small.
Hall says the state can find ways to cut costs and improve insurance on its own without the feds. But Senator French chides the Parnell administration and says it's not coming up with its own ways to get coverage for the 115,000 uninsured Alaskans.
Well, I can promise you that when Linda Hall comes in front of the legislature next year for her annual budget, you know, I'm going to be sort of proposing that she must be overflowing with money and must not need anything whatsoever from us because she's got everything she needs, given that we're turning down federal dollars to help her do her job better. And the same goes for the governor.
French and Senator Begich are also upset because the state isn't giving some of the health care laws perks to its retirees, like one of the most popular benefits, having children covered to the age of 26. But the state is not required to do that. And Rachel Petro, the deputy commissioner who oversees the Division of Retirement and Benefits for the state, says it would be a costly move.
We need to enter into a dialogue with the legislature because ultimately they appropriate the funds that contribute to the retiree health plan. And since this is not something that retirees have obviously paid into, since it would be a new benefit and a new provision, there would be costs associated with that.
When it comes to taking federal funds, the state can apply in future rounds, and the Parnell administration says it will make decisions about taking money for the health care law on a case-by-case basis. In the meantime, elements of the law are being phased in throughout the country. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Political and tribal leaders met with Yukon Kuskokwim residents for a roundtable talk on suicide prevention yesterday in Bethel. It was an emotional discussion. Many came forward with personal stories about how suicide has affected their lives. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
You don't have to look far in the YK Delta to see the devastating impacts of suicide. Western Alaska leads the nation in the grim statistic. This summer, 11 people took their own lives within a few months. And then weeks ago, the village of Hooper Bay lost another young man.
You know, I'm tired of suicides. I'm tired of seeing it around.
Erica Stone of Hooper Bay spoke of a close cousin she lost, and then a sister.
Now, even I thought about suicide before. Even this past winter, I was close to attempting. And I was just thinking, praying, God, I know you have a purpose for me. I know all this pain isn't here for no reason. And I see that you've given reason for me to relate to those who are hurting through this area.
Many young adults seized the opportunity to speak about their experiences. They said they see many of their peers struggling from the effects of drug and alcohol abuse in their households and bullying at their schools.
The young people struggle with that, looking at their lives as trash because of all the things they've been through. But our youth are crying out for love in so many different ways. And just like so many other things in life, you feel this emptiness inside you that you just can't seem to fill no matter how much you try.
Several presenters from the Yukon village of Alakanuk presented ways they're trying to protect their children. Nancy Ayunarak is a health aide from the village. She recalled a time when suicides were prevalent, but she says that's changed.
We taught the children reasons to live and not to start drinking alcohol or taking drugs. We call it Slamdunginun.
That project is coordinated with funding from the National Institute of Health and the Center for Alaska Native Health Research. Ayunarak says that it's been over 3 years now since the village lost anyone to suicide. She says the program has pulled the people there together.
Communication among the community people got better. People who used to drink every weekend didn't drink anymore. And people who didn't communicate at all to their children start communicating. And it sort of, you can feel it in the village, the change, and it makes you feel good.
These guys are so sincere, and it worked in their community. They want this to go out to the other villages.
Billy Charles is now the coordinator for Alaganuk's wellness project. He said much of the project is structured around building interdependence between the community members. He said their model is based on times before Western contact.
There was a qaziq, a communal place where everybody got together, and this is where they made the decision. These guys, they were professors. They had an institutional review board, an IRB, when they were going to do an activity or when they were going to try something. And they had it down to science. And what we're doing in our communities is using this Qaziq model and trying to capture the protective factors that our elders had taught us for years.
The program puts a heavy emphasis on opening dialogues with youth and doing activities with them. But Dr. Jim Allen says it's more than just hunting and fishing trips. It's also talking to children about their important role in the community.
Our research evidence shows that as young people attend more and more of these activities on measures we've developed, the protective factors grow.
Allen is a professor of psychology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he's partnering with the project. He says it will be some time before the program can definitively be called a success.
We work with 12 to 18-year-olds, but we don't expect to see the real outcome of this work until a decade, until these young people reach their 20s. And if we're successful, they will have been protected through their young adult lives.
Mike Williams Sr., a tribal leader from the Kuskokwim village of Akiak, says they're not waiting for the final results. They recently began implementing parts of Alaganuk's program in their village.
The elders are beginning to stand up, and they are talking, and talking along with our youth in our village.
In the end, there was no silver bullet, no promise of new funding to help make things right. But many said they're hopeful the dialogue energized people that want to help and gave some comfort to those suffering. I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Alaska's first economist, George Rogers.
With his wonderful sense of humor, twinkly eyes, he just inspired everybody around him.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Candidates in this year's state races have released the first campaign financial reports required since the August primary election. With 4 weeks to go, both of the major gubernatorial contenders show they have enough funding to meet their needs, but they could use more. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
In documents given to the Alaska Public Offices Commission this week, Democrat Ethan Berkowitz is leading the pack in new contributions, receiving $208,000 from nearly 1,000 contributors. Berkowitz says it shows confidence in the subjects he's been talking about.
We're working hard to make sure that we can continue to get the message out, and that we want to make sure that Alaskans know that we've got a plan for the state's future. We've got a way of moving forward on a gas line, way of bringing low-cost energy to the state, and it's really important that that word gets across Alaska.
Of the money Berkowitz has received, $34,000 was donated by the state or local Democratic organizations, and nearly $70,000 was transferred from his run for the Democratic nomination in August. Republican Governor Sean Parnell's reports show his campaign, which includes money that he and his running mate Meade Treadwell have collected individually, has received less, $181,000. $40,000 of those dollars came from the state Republican Party. As a total, since filing for office last spring, Parnell and Treadwell have raised some $750,000, compared to Berkowitz and Benson's $515,000. Treadwell says both he and Parnell had expensive primary races to get the party nominations, and they expect to raise more as they see Republicans coming together again.
We've been reaching out to Walker voters and to Samuels voters. We're moving ahead. We are raising money both for our own campaigns and also helping the Republican Party raise money, and because I think it's very important that we get the kind of legislature that's going to help Governor Parnell accomplish his agenda.
The bottom line shows that Berkowitz had more than twice as much money in the banks when the reporting period closed, showing nearly $80,000 ready to spend. That's compared to Parnell and Treadwell's $45,000. The bulk of the money in the next few weeks will go toward traveling expenses and advertising. Treadwell says the Republicans' campaign is in the process of buying time for advertisements that have already been produced. Berkowitz has already bought TV and radio time for ads that are ready to go. Both Parnell and Berkowitz and their running mates will spend most of the next few weeks on the road, looking for money, but mostly looking for voters. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Alaska is likely in for a colder than average winter. The climate phenomenon known as La Niña, the cool sister of El Niño, has set up in the equatorial Pacific, and according to National Weather Service lead forecaster Rick Thoman in Fairbanks, it looks powerful.
This appears to be shaping up to be a strong La Niña, perhaps the one of the strongest in the 60 years that we have good data for. It is virtually certain at this point we will have a La Niña for the winter, and it's very likely it'll be in the strong or moderate category.
Thoman says that La Niña tends to keep the jet stream south of Alaska, making it colder here. Thoman and fellow Fairbanks meteorologist Corey Bogal recently went through National Weather Service records, which go accurately back 60 years, and found strong correlations between La Niña events and cooler than normal winters in Alaska.
Now, that doesn't mean that it stays cold all the time. It can certainly warm up for a day or a week. And also in interior Alaska, a primary impact is that since 1950, every single strong or moderate La Niña has had more than 10 days with 40 below temperatures in Fairbanks.
Thoman says the only exception to the cooler-than-normal La Niña trend is in southern southeast Alaska. Thoman says the state's coastal areas tend to be drier in La Niña years, but there's no strong correlation between La Niña and precipitation in the interior. The current La Niña is expected to last through next spring. The La Niña-El Niño cycle can take 3 to 5 years or rapidly transition from one to the other.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
In an effort to reduce the high cost of living in rural Alaska, one community has joined together on an agricultural project that promises to supply the village with nutritious vegetables, fresh local eggs, and a renewable source of income into the future. KDLG's Adam Kane has the story.
Erin Forbes is the community agriculture director in Igiagig. She says the community project started about 10 years ago with just one man who decided to raise some chickens in his backyard.
It just grew from there as the village took interest in these chickens and the eggs they were laying. Then it became a community egg stand where elders could get eggs for free and then $4 a dozen for the rest of the community. Then there was a village potato plot that they started where at the end of the season there's a huge potato party and everyone makes a potato-related dish and there's a potluck and festivities. And it's just grown from there as the interest in the community has built around agriculture and the shared experiences you can have around that. And so they invested in some machinery, a rototiller, and then in the hoop house, and now finally in this very large solar greenhouse.
Construction on the greenhouse was completed just a couple weeks ago. However, village residents are already seeing an improvement from the previously used high tunnel, which wasn't strong enough to stand up to the bears or the wind. Forbes says that the new greenhouse is much more durable.
So the greenhouse is 50 feet by 25 feet. It's made out of real nice, durable, UV-protected plastic with aluminum and steel framing. It's heated by a central boiler where they burn their recycled cardboard and brush pile that then heats the floor, and then there's also forced air heating with water. And then all the electricity comes from 3 windmills that are out behind the greenhouse.
She says in the 10 weeks the wind turbines have been up and running, they've already produced about 1,500 kilowatts of energy. The next step for the community project is to attempt to grow vegetables indoors through the winter. The electricity generated by the windmills will be used to run grow lights, which when paired up with the cardboard-fired burner, will allow the community garden to be heated and lit year-round. Igiagig is a small community of approximately 64 people, and everyone in the village is involved either by eating the produce or by actually getting their hands dirty working on the garden. Next summer, which will be the project's first full growing season, the community plans to hire a full-time employee who will be paid by the council from revenue earned through the sales of vegetables to the community and area fishing and hunting lodges. The majority of the community agriculture project was funded through a number of grants. Forbes says that they are proud with what they've achieved. However, she wants to remind other communities that it takes a lot of work to succeed.
That really depends on the support of the community. You really have to have people rallying behind you. Igiagig is such a small community that it really works as a nice model. This is what can be done when you're really at the grassroots level. So then taking it and extrapolating from there, I think, is a really nice idea.
Greenhouses and the materials necessary for an agriculture project are not cheap to bring into rural Alaska. Forbes says that without the grant funding and the wealthy neighbors in the form of high-end hunting and fishing lodges, the project in Igiagig would probably have taken many years to see a return on the investment. Various types of food preservation are traditionally used by Alaska Native communities to save food through the long cold winters. Forbes says that area residents are interested in continuing the traditional fashion by finding new ways of preserving the food grown in the community project.
We're hoping to apply for another grant for root cellaring, some kind of cold storage. A lot of members of the village, though, are very interested in food preservation, have a lot of background in that, so we don't expect it to be a problem when we finally have the produce needed for those kinds of activities.
I'm Adam Kane.
George Rogers is often remembered as a big thinker for his contributions to Alaska statehood, his economic studies, a quick wit, and sense of humor. He was a scholar, an author, and professor. He served on numerous local and statewide boards and commissions, including the Alaska Permanent Fund. Rogers died Sunday at his Juneau home. He was 93 years old. He spoke with reporters many times at member station KTOO, and this remembrance from Rosemarie Alexander includes some of those interviews.
And I said to Jean, I said, "This is my island."
George Rogers and his wife Jean came to Alaska by steamship in 1945 when he worked for the U.S. Office of Price Administration, a federal agency created during World War II to prevent wartime inflation. Years later, in his first book on the economic consequences of statehood, he writes, "The only proper way to meet Alaska is by boat, traveling up the Inside Passage, the vertical land rising upward to the sky." Rogers notes that for some, it would be claustrophobic. His former student, Greg Erickson, reads Rogers' words.
"To us, there was a feeling of shelter and protection from the current savagery of the outside. The time was January 1945.
The young couple settled in Juneau, then the capital of the Alaska Territory. Rogers quickly established his credentials and has often been called Alaska's first economist. Erickson says he certainly was the most preeminent.
George was the first person to really evoke an understanding of how the Alaska economy worked and how it has changed over the years.
I knew Alaska was going to change because when I looked at the statistics on the imports and exports from Alaska, almost 90% of the value exported from Alaska was represented by canned salmon and petroleum.
Alaska became Rogers' economic island of study.
Because everything that went in and out of Alaska was measured, and it was an abnormal society, abnormal economy. One of my professors said, "You don't learn anything studying a functioning economy. What you want to study is ones that are not functioning. Find out why they're not functioning. That will bring you to the truth." So it was just perfect for me.
He became part of the statehood movement and was a key economic consultant at the 1955-56 Constitutional Convention. Delegate Vic Fisher credits him with laying out the economic basis for the new state, from the native subsistence lifestyle to its natural resource exports. Fisher collaborated with him on many projects over the years, but says it was Rogers' vision for a university research center that may be his most lasting legacy. In 1961, Rogers convinced Governor Bill Egan and the state legislature that a state needed a center for economic and business research. He described that in a 1980s interview with KTOO.
I had made a proposal for structuring research within the state government, in which I would have basic research at the university in all fields, developmental research in either the Alaska Development Board or something, and then planning research in the governor's office. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, but we did get an Institute of Social Economic Research set up. And for a couple of years, I was the institute.
It's now the Institute of Social and Economic Research, headquartered at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Fisher became its first director.
George spent a lot of time with the researchers guiding the work, and with his wonderful sense of humor and twinkly eyes, it just inspired everybody around him.
Roger's 22-page resume does not list his many roles in local theater, Walt Disney's movie White Fang, lyric opera, and as the king in Princess Ida.
If you give me your attention, I will tell you what I am. I'm a genuine philanthropist, all other types of sham.
Fisher calls him a Renaissance man. Perseverance Theater founding director Molly Smith says he was one of the few people who got what she was trying to do 32 years ago, create an Alaskan voice in theater.
He was with us from the very beginning because of his intelligence and also his love for the state and love for the theater. Really understood in a deep way what Perseverance Theater was about. And that was so important for us as a young company and as a growing company.
Roger started in set design, but was soon a literary advisor and acted in countless productions. And 25 years ago, violinist and Juno Jazz and Classics founder Linda Rosenthal called on him to be a member of the first festival board for his Renaissance ability to combine love of music and economic analysis.
When George spoke, we listened.
George and Jean Rogers would be married 69 years next month. He met her in an English literature class at the University of California, Berkeley. Jean is a well-known children's author with many titles to her name. During an interview on his life, he once told a reporter,
"She should be here right now. In fact, I'm only half a person without her."
George Rogers is survived by his wife, Jean, 5 children, and 10 grandchildren. A community celebration of his life is planned for April, when he would have been 94. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Adam Kane in Dillingham, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.